From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! Broadcasting from Tampa, Florida.
Yesterday, a Canadian commission of inquiry confirmed what many of us have known for a long time, that Makar Arar, the man deported to Syria and tortured, sent there by the United States, was completely innocent of any terrorism charges.
As the Canadian government declares Makar Arar an innocent man, we'll look at how the Bush administration is seeking congressional authority to torture detainees and strip them of habeas corpus. Then Lieutenant Aaron Watada, the first officer to publicly to refuse to serve in Iraq, is charged again by the military, this time for conduct unbecoming an officer and a gentleman.
I see the path that our country is taking is so wrong and so destructive, all from the conduct and the ideology of our leadership. And I just think anything I can do to put a stop to this, to make things right, I'll do it.
And we'll get a report from Lebanon on the country's efforts to rebuild. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, broadcasting from Tampa, Florida. The Canadian government has acknowledged for the first time that one of the most well-known victims of CIA extraordinary rendition is a completely innocent man. On Monday, a judge concluded a major investigation in the case of Makar Arar. He's the Syrian-born Canadian citizen detained nearly 4 years ago by U.S. authorities at John F. Kennedy Airport in New York. Rather than being released and sent home to his family in Canada, Arar ended up in a Syrian jail where he was repeatedly tortured. U.S. officials accused him of links to Al-Qaeda. On Monday, Justice Dennis O'Connor wrote, quote, "I am able to say categorically there's no evidence to indicate that Mr. Arar has committed any offense or that his activities constituted a threat to the security of Canada." The Canadian inquiry concluded that Canadian officials did not play a direct role in Makar Arar's detention or deportation. However, the judge found the U.S. government's decision to send Arar to Syria was likely based on inaccurate and misleading information provided by Canadian authorities. The judge also criticized Canadian officials for leaking confidential and sometimes inaccurate information about Arar to the media for the purpose of damaging his reputation or protecting the government's interests. Although the Canadian report focused on the Canadian government, Judge O'Connor also had criticism for U.S. officials. He wrote, quote, "The American authorities who handled Mr. Arar's case treated Mr. Arar in a most regrettable fashion. They removed him to Syria against his wishes and in the face of his statements that he would be tortured if sent there." Sudan is facing growing international pressure to allow the African Union to maintain its troop presence in Darfur. The AU's mandate is set to expire at the end of the month. On Monday, UN Special Envoy to Sudan, Jan Pronk, appealed for an extension.
The AU is less effective than it was a year ago, but its presence is essential. Departure of the African Union leaves the people in the camps unprotected and vulnerable to anyone who would wish to harm them and resume the cleansing of 2003 and 2004.
It's good. The UN has warned a withdrawal of African Union troops could lead to more killings of civilians and cut off access for humanitarian workers. The Sudanese government has not decided on the African Union force, but continues to reject Western intervention. Sudanese Vice President Ali Osman Taha spoke Monday in Khartoum.
The entry of foreign or UN forces in Darfur will mean disaster. The resistance and rejection that these UN forces will meet will transform Darfur into a new Iraq and a new arena for confrontation between the international forces and national will.
In Iraq, more than 70 people were killed in another day of relentless violence. A suicide bombing killed 13 people outside a police center in Ramadi. In Tal Afar, at least 20 people died in a suicide attack on a busy market street. At the UN Monday, Secretary General Kofi Annan warned Iraq is descending into civil war.
If current patterns of alienation and violence persist much longer, there is a grave danger that the Iraqi state will break down, possibly in the midst of a full-scale civil war.
In other news, French President Jacques Chirac has split with the Bush administration's stance on Iran. Chirac now says the UN Security Council should not take action while negotiations continue over Iran's nuclear program. Chirac's the first European leader to back Iran's call to negotiate without preconditions. The Bush administration wants Iran to freeze nuclear activities before it comes to the table. It's pushing UN Security Council sanctions if Iran does not agree. In Hungary, massive protests were held Monday following the release of a secret recording in which the prime minister admits to lying about the economy. On the tape, he's heard admitting he lied, quote, morning, evening, and night to win elections in April. Hundreds of people took to the streets to demand his resignation. A group of protesters briefly occupied Hungary's state television station before being driven out by police. The prime minister has not denied making the statements, but says he will not resign. In Somalia, 11 people were killed Tuesday in a suicide bombing targeting President Abdullahi Yusuf. Yusuf escaped unharmed, but his brother is among the dead. The attack is believed to be the first suicide bombing in Somalia's history. The U.S. and Israel are warning Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas against finalizing a deal for a unity government with Hamas. Abbas reached an agreement with Hamas last week and is now working out the final details. But in separate talks Monday, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and Israeli Foreign Minister Tzipi Livni told Abbas they would not accept the Palestinian government unless Hamas renounces terror and recognizes Israel's right to exist. Meanwhile, the UN Security Council has agreed to hold a session Thursday on a four-year-old offer from the Arab League that calls for full peace with Israel in return for an Israeli withdrawal from all occupied territories. Both the U.S. and Israel oppose the proposal. In Geneva, the annual conference for a global ban on landmines opened Monday, with calls for new limits on the use of cluster bombs. The Swiss Foundation for Mine Action says new rules are needed in light of Israel's recent bombardment of Lebanon. This is the group's director, Hansborg Eberle.
Lebanon, unfortunately, from what we know, in the last few days of the war, Israel must have used massive amounts of cluster bombs. So Lebanon already has a residual landmines problem from previous wars, but on top of it now it also has a massive cluster bomb problem.
The conference is also calling on 40 remaining countries to sign the international treaty banning landmines, including China, Russia, and the United States. Here in the United States, Vice President Dick Cheney's former company, Halliburton, is again under scrutiny over its practices in Iraq. On Capitol Hill Monday, Democratic lawmakers held a hearing over a deadly ambush that killed 7 employees and injured 26 others in Iraq 2 years ago. Relatives of the dead and surviving employees have filed suit against the company for sending them on an assignment, despite knowing it was fraught with danger. According to CBS News, a former manager of the Halliburton subsidiary, Kellogg Brown and Root, said the convoy was sent because company executives wanted to show improved performance. KBR denies wrongdoing and says it should be immune from lawsuits. But a newly released document indicates KBR officials have had high concern over legal action. In a letter sent to Ray Stannard, one of the surviving employees, KBR offered to help him win a Defense of Freedom Medal in return for waiving his right to sue. And finally, in media news, the Federal Communication Commission is facing new allegations of censorship following the disclosure the agency buried another critical study of media consolidation. Last week, a former FCC lawyer revealed top officials ordered staff to destroy all copies of a draft study that warned against concentration of media ownership. That report found local ownership adds almost 5 minutes of total news to broadcast and more than 3 minutes of on-location news. This week, the newly discovered report argued the 1996 Telecommunications Act led to a drastic decline in the number of radio station owners, even as the number of radio stations increased. The study was never released. Both former FCC Chair Michael Powell and current Chair Kevin Martin deny ever seeing the report. In a letter sent to Martin this week, the StopBigMedia.com coalition says the FCC should allow an independent investigation. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting from Tampa, Florida. I'm Amy Goodman. Well, 4 years ago, this month, a Canadian citizen named Maher Arar was on his way back to Canada from a family vacation in Tunisia. The Syrian-born man had a stopover at JFK Airport in New York. The date, September 26, 2002. He wouldn't see his family for another 374 days. After being questioned at the airport, U.S. officials took him to an immigration facility in New York. 2 weeks later, he was secretly flown to Jordan aboard a Gulfstream jet. Maher Arar ended up in Syria, where he was held in a cell the size of a grave. He was repeatedly tortured. For weeks, his family didn't even know where he was. On Monday, the Canadian government admitted for the first time Arar was a completely innocent man. Justice Dennis O'Connor released the findings of a two-year major investigation into the disappearance of Arar. The judge wrote, quote, "I'm able to say categorically there's no evidence to indicate Mr. Arar has committed any offense or that his activities constitute a threat to the security of Canada." The official inquiry said there's no evidence that Canadian officials played a direct role in his detention or deportation. However, Justice O'Connor found the U.S. government's decision to send Arar to Syria was likely based on inaccurate and misleading information provided by Canadian authorities. The judge also criticized the Bush administration's actions. The judge wrote, quote, "They removed him to Syria against his wishes and in the face of his statements that he would be tortured if sent there." Maher Arar's attorney, Maria LaHood, joins us on the phone right now. She's a lawyer with the Center for Constitutional Rights, and she is in Canada. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thanks, Amy.
Maria LaHood. It's good to have you with us. You have spent the last few days with Maher Arar. Can you talk about his reaction to the judge's finding and clearly lay out what this report says?
Maher's really relieved. He's certainly happy to have his name finally cleared and to try to move on with his life. The inquiry, as you mentioned, it's been a two-year process. You know, the judge, the commissioner, looked at over 20,000 documents. There were over 70 witnesses. There was in-camera testimony. He looked at all of the national security documents, and he basically found that, as you said, there was no evidence implicating Maher in terrorism. There had been a long investigation by law enforcement agencies here, and it actually even continued after Maher got back from Syria. And the investigation included U.S. cooperation. The justice said, the commissioner said, that the U.S. never provided Canada with its own information to support that Maher had al-Qaeda ties, and that it likely would have, given the close cooperation, if it had had it. So all of this incorrect information, this inflammatory information that Canada provided to the U.S. was what was used in the U.S.'s designation of him as an al-Qaeda member and to send him to Syria to be tortured. Some of that information, first of all, the RCMP here gave information to the U.S. saying that Maher and his wife Monia were Islamic extremists with al-Qaeda ties. That was just false. Every witness that the inquiry interviewed said that was false and that there was no reason to say that, no basis at all. There was evidence, statements given to the U.S. government saying that Maher was in the vicinity of Washington, D.C. on 9/11. That was false. They said that when they requested an interview with Maher, that he refused to be interviewed and suddenly left to Tunisia. That was patently false. So this is the information that the U.S. government used to determine that he was an al-Qaeda member and to send him to Syria to be tortured. And now this is the information that they claim, I imagine, is a state secret, which prevents him from seeking justice in the United States for what they did to him.
I first interviewed Maher Arar in 2003. It was November, just a few weeks after he was sent back to Canada from Syria. He described what happened to him there.
Really, I mean, when I arrived there, I just couldn't believe it. I thought first it was a dream. I was crying all the time. I was disoriented. I wished I had something in my hand to kill myself, because I knew I was going to be tortured, and this was my preoccupation. That's all I was thinking about when I was on the plane. And I arrived there, I was crying all the time. So one of them started questioning me, and the others were taking notes. And first day, it was mainly routine questions between 8 to 12. And the second day, that's when the beating started. Because, you know, in the first day, they did not find anything strange about what I told them. And they started beating me with a cable, electrical threaded cable. And they would beat me for 3-4 times. They would stop again, and they would ask questions again. And they always kept telling me, "You are a liar," and things like that. So the beating continued for the first 2 weeks. The intensive beating was really the first week. And then after that, it was mostly slapping, punching on the face, and kicking. So on the third day, when they didn't find anything, third or fourth day, they, in my view, they just wanted to please the Americans, and they had to find something on me. So because I was accused of being an Al-Qaeda member, which is nowadays synonymous with Afghanistan, they told me, "You've been to a training camp in Afghanistan." Mm. And I said, no, and they started beating me. And I said, well, I had no choice. I just wanted the beating to stop. I said, of course, I've been to Afghanistan. So I was ready to confess to anything just to stop the torture.
That was Maher Arar speaking to us in November of 2003, just after he had been released from the Syrian jail and was back in Canada. We spoke to him again just months ago, talking about the psychological effects of that year's detention. This is Maher Arar again.
I'm completely a different person. I still have fears. I don't take the plane anymore. I don't fly. I lost confidence in myself. I feel overwhelmed. There's some kind of emotional distancing between me and my kids and my family. They ruined my life. They ruined my life, and I have not been able to find a job. People try to, you know, some people I know, they try to distance themselves from me. It's I don't know how to describe it. I don't think there is any word I could use to describe what I'm going through. And I thought when I came back, it would take me a month or 2 months or a year or 2 years to get back to normal life. It's been 2 years and 4 months since I came back to Canada. And there are things that I've improved a little bit, but I'm still not the same person, and I'm still suffering psychologically.
That is Maher Arar speaking to us in February of this year. This is years after his year detention in Syria, after he was tortured. He was sent there through the CIA's extraordinary rendition, as it is called. Maria LaHood is with us in Vancouver, in Ottawa. She has been with Maher Arar. Maria, can you describe what it was like when the judge handed down his findings?
Well, it was, you know, these findings are over, it's three volumes, and it's over 1,200 or almost 1,200 pages. So, you know, we were given the reports to look through. So everyone was furiously trying to look for information, and, you know, we were all thrilled to see that Maher's name was cleared. There was some information in there that came out that was new information, you know, like this false information that the RCMP gave the U.S. that was really troubling. There was also information that Maher's, you know, not only Maher's wife was put on a list, but actually his children were put into intelligence data banks. You know, they're 9 and 4 now. They were 1 years old and 5 years old before, and so it was really troubling to see that. But really quite a relief and exciting to have a public inquiry in this country, to have people applauding Maher for the hero that he is. You know, today it's on the front page of all the newspapers. It's amazing, and especially in comparison to what happens in the U.S., you know, where they still claim he's an al-Qaeda member and won't let anything be released. So
The Ottawa Citizen reporter, Juliet O'Neill, her home, was broken into by the authorities in Canada. She was one of those who had reported on what happened to Maher Arar.
Right. There was, you know, a big part of the investigation has to do with what happened after Maher got back, and the fact that there were government leaks. There was, you know, not only just government incompetence, but what seems to be, you know, an effort to ruin his reputation, to claim he wasn't tortured, to sort of stain his name. And I think that's the same thing that's being done in the U.S., basically, by keeping secrets and saying he's a member of al-Qaeda. You know, you can cast doubt on the unlawful, atrocious behavior of the government. And I think that's what's been done. But now, at least, there is a clear record and a clear statement by the commission that Maher's been cleared. I mean, of course, these findings have to be accepted by the Canadian government, along with all the findings. I mean, you know, one of the findings is that the Canadian government should register its objections with the U.S. government for how what happened to Maher, for how he was treated. Like you said, for the fact they sent him to Syria despite his objection, despite the fact that he said he would be tortured. The fact that the U.S. officials were less than forthcoming with the Canadian officials about what they were going to do. They didn't let them know that Syria was an option until the day before they sent him. They breached the Vienna Conventions on consular relations by not contacting the Canadian consulate for 5 days. These are all findings in the report.
And so what happens now? I mean, you have the judge in the United States, David Traeger, who wrote in response to your lawsuit, Maher Arar's lawsuit, here in the United States. He wrote in the judgment, "One need not have much imagination to contemplate the negative effect on our relations with Canada if discovery were to proceed in this case and were it to turn out that certain high Canadian officials had, despite public denials, acquiesced in Arar's removal to Syria."
Exactly. This commission finding completely alleviates that concern by finding that Canadian officials were not complicit in Maher's detention in the United States or in his removal to Syria. I mean, the reason that the judge dismissed this case, he claimed that national security and foreign policy considerations precluded him from holding the federal officials liable, even if what they did violated customary international law and violated our treaties. And what you said, that was one of the reasons that he was concerned about relations with Canada, because of if it came out that Canadian officials were complicit. And this report says they're not complicit. They were not complicit in his rendition to Syria. I mean, I think another...
Go ahead.
Okay. The other, I mean, you know, the even after, I mean, we're appealing the dismissal now on these grounds, and we hope that that will be successful. I mean, we still face the government's state secrets assertion, which is where they say that the reason they deemed him a member of al-Qaeda is a state secret, and the reason we sent him to Syria instead of Canada is a state secret. Well, here we now know, you know, that it's very likely that the reason they deemed him an al-Qaeda member is this incorrect information from Canada. And the fact that more information has become public undermines the state secrets privilege. The fact that, you know, other governments are investigating this and the U.S. won't, will hopefully put pressure on the government to actually investigate, pressure to actually disclose information about what happened to Maher.
And in Canada right now, what about compensation, Vermaherar, his Canadian lawyer, Julian Falconer, saying there's recommending some kind of compensation, and Maharar's separate civil suit against police services and federal agencies. Is the government quietly negotiating with him right now upon the release that completely vindicates him of this report?
Well, the commissioner did put in his recommendations that the government should assess Maher's claim for compensation in light of his findings and respond accordingly. So, you know, there will be, I'm sure, some discussions of how that's going to happen. It hasn't been decided yet how it will be done.
And any evaluation going on in the press of how the media was used by the government to smear, to tar Maher Arar?
You know, I haven't seen that, but, you know, it's a very good point. And I think, there were a lot of people who were complicit in what happened to Maher. You know, it doesn't just stop with the high government officials. There were people in low-level positions in the INS. There were people in, you know, there were the private jets. There were the people who didn't get the information out. There were the people that got the misinformation out. And there are people that continue to be complicit in what happened to him. And hopefully, the more information that comes out, the more we will find out. And eventually, I hope that Maher will be cleared in the U.S. as well.
Maria LaHood, I want to thank you for joining us from Vancouver. Maria LaHood is the attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights representing Maher Arar, who has just been completely vindicated by a Canadian report. He had been the subject of what's called extraordinary rendition by the U.S. government, taken off a plane at Kennedy Airport and sent off to Syria, where he was tortured. When we come back, we'll be joined by the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, Michael Ratner, to talk not only about this case, but what's going on in Washington, D.C., and the Republican revolt on the issue of torture. Stay with us.
Living in the wasteland of the free. We got preachers dealing in politics and diamond mines. And their speech is growing increasingly unkind. Running races on corporate cash. Now don't tell me they don't turn around and kiss them people's ass. You may call me old-fashioned, that don't fit my picture of a true democracy. It feels like I am living in the wasteland of the free.
That was Iris Dement, Wasteland of the Free. And as we continue our Breaking the Sound Barrier tour around the country, DN at 10, Democracy Now, 10 years old, we'll be with Iris Dement in Kansas City on September 30th at the Christian Community Church. Today in Tampa, we'll be tonight at the Tampa Theater celebrating WMNF Community Radio. Today at 1, we'll be in Sarasota at New Campus at the Sudikoff Center. Well, new details have been revealed on the Republican divide over the Bush administration's plan for the treatment of prisoners in U.S. custody. Newsweek magazine reports the administration wants to maintain at least 7 existing CIA interrogation methods for use against high-level detainees. The techniques include induced hypothermia, long periods of forced standing, sleep deprivation, and so-called attention slapping. The administration is facing resistance from 3 key Republican senators on the Armed Services Committee, John McCain, Lindsey Graham, and John Warner. The 3 senators helped pass a measure last week affirming Common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions, which prohibits inhumane treatment. To talk about this debate over interrogation tactics, Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, joins us in our studio in New York. Welcome, Michael, to Democracy Now!
Welcome, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. Talk about this debate that's going on within the Republican Party.
Well, you know, what's extraordinary about everything that's going on now in Washington, you know, you just covered the Maher Arar case.
And sadly, none of it would really stop what happened to Machar Arar, which is the taking of someone, outsourcing torture to another country, sending him to a place where he could be tortured. So I want to just start that this is an important debate in Washington, but it's not going to stop the tragic cases like Machar Arar, of which I think there's many, many cases. I just want to make that clear. The debate is really in Washington on three issues. One of them has not been covered at all. The first issue is what kind of interrogation techniques can be used. Can torture be used? Can you violate common Article 3? Can you use those techniques you spoke about, including, I think, waterboarding, which is the mock drowning of somebody? And on those issues, McCain, Warner, and Graham have taken a position that they don't want those used. And so we're at loggerheads between two factions of the Republicans right now. I don't know how it will come out. I certainly hope that McCain and Warner stick and Graham to their position on that. But there's two other issues going on, one of which has not been covered at all. One is, of course, the military commissions. And again, the McCain bill, which is not the administration bill, is better on that as well. It doesn't allow you to use evidence from torture. It makes sure the defendant in a military commission is present at trial and gives a person more rights at a military commission. But the third issue, which has not been covered, is to me very critical and is in both of the pieces of legislation, in both the administration bill and in the McCain-Graham bill, McCain-Graham-Warner bill. In both cases, you abolish the writ of habeas corpus. The government, the Congress, is abolishing the writ of habeas corpus. The habeas corpus writ is the right to challenge your detention once you're picked up by the United States. It would apply to Guantanamo, it would apply to everybody in Bagram, and it basically says that anybody picked up now or in the future or is there now no longer has the writ of habeas corpus. For some reason, for some peculiar reason, nobody is really covering this in the media. Yes, they're covering the McCain debate over waterboarding and torture and somewhat on the military commissions, but not really the denial of the abolishment of the fundamental writ. If we look at Machar Arar, his is one of the cases. I mean, there may be Machar Arars, there are, as I know, in places like Guantanamo and other places in the world, and without an ability to bring those cases to court, the United States can continue, or the administration can continue, doing what it did to Machar Arar.
Now, again, maybe part of the reason we don't hear much about this is a lack of understanding of writ of habeas corpus. I mean, it's not even in English. Explain, Michael.
Well, you know, it actually comes initially out of the Magna Carta in 1215. And it had to do with when the king just believed he could pick up people anywhere in the world, throw them into a dungeon, never give them a court hearing, and you never hear from them again, essentially disappear them. Out of a long struggle for people's rights, the writ of habeas corpus emerged. When we wrote our Constitution in the United States, it was considered the fundamental right, essentially against a police state, and can only be suspended in cases of rebellion or things like that. And what it really says is that if the king or the president picks me up anywhere in the world, that I have a right to go into court and say, what are your reasons for detaining me? It doesn't say you have to be freed, but it says you have to come up, government, come up with a legal reason for detaining me. In other words, it takes detentions, disappearances, and puts them into the light of a courtroom where the government has to justify the detention. That's the fundamental right that we at the Center for Constitutional Rights won for those people at Guantanamo, and which this Congress and this president have continuously tried to beat back. We won it in 2004. We got a legislation that Congress had passed to try and get rid of it. We won that again in 2006, and now they're trying to get rid of it again. It's really, I mean, the fundamental right that protects us against just arbitrary arrest and disappearance. It's absolutely crucial, and so far, unfortunately, I just want to emphasize this, both the administration bill and the McCain bill abolish the writ of habeas corpus. And if there should be a massive, massive public campaign about that, people can go to the center's website and get information about that and get to their senators and say, don't abolish the writ. This is the protection that will protect the Machar Arars in the world, that protect our Guantanamo detainees, and protect people who are really disappeared all over the world.
Hmm. no Democrats have stood up to defend habeas corpus?
Oh, no, there are some. It's happening. I mean, it's just not in the public dialogue or discourse right now. But certainly within the Senate, there are Democrats who are extremely, extremely concerned by the abolishment of the writ of habeas corpus. The problem is right now, of course, in an election year, Democrats feel they don't want to necessarily oppose the administration on that issue. They're happy to see the Republicans and the Democrats fight about the use of torture, and they're not really raising this issue. But let me just say, abolishment of the writ, those who abolish it will really go down in infamy as really taking away the fundamental constitutional right, a right that goes back to 1215. I still believe that we have a chance of sustaining and allowing that writ to continue. But we are at an extremely serious juncture. This administration does not want courts examining what it does to people like Mahar Arar or our clients at Guantanamo or what it's doing around the world to detainees. And that's why it wants to get rid of the writ. And it's really a legal and political and moral outrage. You know, I couldn't, in your story on Mahar Arar, big tears, I have to tell you, just rolled down my eyes for him and what we did to this human being. And sadly, that's only one of the cases. There are scores, if not hundreds of cases right now where people who are innocent or people who have not made any kind of attacks against the United States but were picked up on flimsy evidence like Arar was, are in detention and are unable to get any hearings in federal court. It's really an outrage, and that Congress would now give this authority to me, would take this authority for habeas away, is just a remarkable, it's breathtaking when you think about it.
Michael Ratner, I asked Maria LaHood about this, your colleague at the Center for Constitutional Rights, but now that this Canadian report has come out, that has to be such an incredible embarrassment to both the Canadian government but also the U.S. The only thing the U.S. government has protecting it now is that the U.S. press hardly picks up on this, right? Mahar Arar was the Time Newsmaker of the Year in Canada. That was Canadian Time. His name is hardly known in this country. But the judge threw out the case here. Can you reinstate it?
Well, we're going on appeal on this case, so I would hope that the Court of Appeals sees through what this judge did. I mean, Maria's point that essentially, yeah, to argue now that somehow this is going to hurt our relations with Canada is absurd. Canada has said exactly what happened. There was never really a threat there. It was an excuse to get rid of this case. But I would imagine that the circuit is going to reinstate this case. This really is the case that brings to the fore and to the foreground the illegality, the harm, and the torture that is caused by our detention policies. You know, one of the things about the Mahar Arar case when it came into the lower court, the district court, the judge, in part of his opinion, actually wrote that it may be okay or not unconstitutional to torture in the name of terrorism. This, to me, is how far this country has gone, that people, even federal judges, are willing to say that. We are so far away from what I consider to be a civilized norms of a society right now, that Mahar Arar's case really stands for just the real terror that this country is now imposing, sadly, on people all over the world in detention.
Mm. Is it just the Republican debate that has opened up this discussion in the press around the issue of torture?
Well, no, it's not just the Republican debate. It's certainly been helpful because, you know, despite the fact that we've all been saying, everybody knows from the Rumsfeld techniques at Guantanamo to everything we've brought out to many reports that torture is, you know, the coin of the realm right now in this country, that sadly the Democrats and the press have been unwilling to take it on and label it what it is and really nail the people from Rumsfeld and others who've approved it. And so only now that the Republicans are standing up, a few of them, a little bit, are we getting some courage in the press and some in the Democrats to stand up and say, hey, guys, you know, we're torturing people. We've been doing it for 5 years. Maybe we shouldn't. But let me say, I have been appalled that for 5 years I'm living in a country that is openly torturing people and essentially proud of it. And despite that, there has been basically pipsqueaks out of the press and out of Congress. You don't see them saying, stop this,
Michael
stop
Ratner,
this, stop this.
Michael Ratner, we just have 10 seconds, but whatever comes out with a bill out of the Senate, out of the Congress, couldn't President Bush just sign a signing statement, as he's done more than 800 times, and not abide by whatever it was that was passed?
He could certainly do a signing statement, like he said, and say, I'm not going to enforce this bill. I'm still going to torture people. It would be unconstitutional. It would be illegal. It would be essentially a war crime to do it, in my view. But the way this president has gone, my belief is that he has committed war crimes.
Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, thank you for joining us. When we come back, the first officer who said no to deployment in Iraq has been hit with another charge, conduct unbecoming an officer and a gentleman. We'll talk to him. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from Tampa, Florida. Conduct unbecoming an officer and a gentleman. That's the latest charge that Lieutenant Aaron Watata has been hit with. He was hit with it on Friday by the Army. Aaron Watata is the first officer to publicly refuse to serve in Iraq. On June 22nd, he refused to deploy with his Fort Lewis-based unit, and he was subsequently charged with one count of missing troop movement, two counts of speaking contemptuously of the president, and four counts of acts unbecoming an officer. Army spokesperson Joe Peek said this latest charge is based on Watata's remarks last month at the National Convention for Veterans for Peace. At the convention, Watata attacked the Bush administration for waging a war, quote, for profit and imperialistic denomination, and urged soldiers to refuse to fight. Lieutenant Watata faces 8 years in prison. I spoke to him on Saturday night in Seattle at Town Hall. I began by asking him his response to the latest charge.
On Friday, yesterday, I was charged with conduct unbecoming an officer and a gentleman. Another count that was added on to the charges already that I, the military has referred to me. Based on the speeches that I had made, and it's kind of saying why I was not deploying, my beliefs on what the administration was doing, and I made another speech recently at the Veterans for Peace conference, and because of that speech, they then charged me again.
What is your response to that charge, conduct unbecoming an officer? What did you say at the Veterans for Peace convention?
I said many things. Basically, I was talking to the peace activists, people who I believe are on the front lines, working for an end to this war and for peace and justice in general. And I was speaking to them generally to say that we, all Americans, have a responsibility to support those service members who are trying to do the right thing. And I was basically saying why I believe this and telling them how they can help out soldiers, service members who are resisting this war.
How did you come to the conclusion, you're the first officer to resist deploying to Iraq, how did you come to the conclusion that it was wrong?
For me, there were many things. The most important thing for me is that in our democracy, according to our Constitution, one person, one man cannot hold absolute power, hold himself above the law, including in actions in declaring war or waging war on another country. And it is my belief that in deceiving the American people, through which a majority of us now know to be true, the leaders of our country were violating their oath to this country, and violating constitutional law. That was the main reason. Other things that led me to this decision was the rampant abuses of American international law and the conduct of the occupation and in the conduct of this war. And I just felt that the policies that were made were forcing soldiers, including myself, to commit actions that violated international and domestic laws.
So what happens to you now? How many counts, how many charges have been brought against you?
Basically, there's one count of missing movement, which has a maximum penalty of 2 years. Two counts of contempt against officials, which is another 2 years, specifically contempt against the President of the United States. And now four charges of conduct unbecoming an officer and a gentleman, all total about 8.5 years.
Will you be court-martialed?
That remains to be seen. It's entirely up to the commanding general of Fort Lewis and also the political forces that are swirling around him. We certainly hope not. We certainly hope that the military will see that it is the duty of every service member to refuse unlawful orders and to speak out against leadership which is not held to account, which is not held accountable.
You live in Olympia. Are you allowed to leave the state of Washington now?
No, I cannot leave the state of Washington. I've tried to request to go home to visit friends and family, for which will probably be the last time I will see them if I'm incarcerated. And they have restricted me from going anywhere outside of the state on the basis that they don't want me making any speeches that will incite people or inspire people. But they have not put any limitations on what I can do in the state of Washington.
You got a tremendous response here at Town Hall of over 1,000 people. What is your response to that, and are you ready to go to jail?
First of all, I think with the response of the people in general, I am eternally grateful. There's been so much warm, encouraging words of support from all over the country, all over the world, and even within the military itself. And that strengthens me, and it gives me more courage to do what I'm doing. Certainly, I don't think anybody is ready for prison, but I feel it's a necessary sacrifice, if that's what it comes down to, and one that I'm willing to make and to do whatever I can to bring democracy back to this country.
Have people in the military expressed their support to you publicly or privately?
Not publicly. I think a lot of taking a risk in using the military email servers to communicate to me their words of support and encouragement. But yes, all over, I don't know about the other services, but I know in the Army, there has been tremendous support from all ranks, from soldiers all around the country, all around the world, even veterans just coming back from Iraq. And certainly not in the majority, I would assume, in the military, but they are out there, many of them.
And specifically the charge, a conduct unbecoming an officer and a gentleman, and the charge contempt, expressing contempt towards the President of the United States. Can you address that, this conduct?
It's the charges, or that article that they charged me with, it's a very arbitrary. I mean, they basically list and quote things that I've said. To wit, as they say, and they say that it's conduct unbecoming because those words are disgraceful and dishonorable. But those terms are so ambiguous, and they could mean different things. The ACLU has come out to my defense and publicly, and they've even written an amicus brief, which we presented at the Article 32 hearing, saying that past instances of which officers have been charged with conduct unbecoming really have no jurisprudence for this case in regarding free speech. Usually things like if an officer fails to pay child support or they commit adultery or they're caught stealing, those are really the what they've charged or what they used to charge officers with. Something with concerning free speech is unprecedented.
Lieutenant Aaron Watada, what gives you your strength?
The opportunity to make a difference. I see the path that our country is taking is so wrong and so destructive. all from the conduct and the ideology of our leadership. And I just think anything I can do to put a stop to this, to make things right, I'll do it.
Lieutenant Aaron Watata speaking on Saturday night. We were in the back of Town Hall, the historic site in Seattle, Washington. And finally, we turn to Lebanon. The Israeli military's chief of staff was quoted as saying the Israeli army will complete a pullout from southern Lebanon within a few days. Ron Cohen, a legislator with the left-wing Meretz Party, said Lieutenant General Dan Chalutz told him all troops would return to Israel by the Jewish New Year, which begins at sunset Friday. There are currently 4,600 international troops in southern Lebanon under a United Nations mandate. The UN brokered ceasefire in August ended the 34-day conflict between Israel and Hezbollah. The month-long conflict killed over 1,000 Lebanese, mostly civilian, wounded many more. Over 150 Israelis, mostly soldiers, were also killed. While the death toll and destruction of infrastructure in Lebanon has been widely reported, what are the long-lasting effects of Lebanon's economy? Democracy Now! Producer Anna Nagara filed this report from Beirut.
As the dust settles on the bombed ruins of Lebanon, the long-term economic effects of the war are coming into dramatic focus. The Lebanese government has put the cost of reconstruction at $10 billion, but that figure is dwarfed by the indirect effects of Israeli strikes to Lebanon's economy. 900 factories, farms, and small businesses have been damaged or destroyed. Power stations, water treatment plants, and hundreds of roads and bridges will cost millions to repair. The country's unemployment rate is at a staggering 75%. Wajid Bizri, president of the Lebanese International Chamber of Commerce, estimates that over $200 million in direct damage was inflicted on the industrial sector, with dairy, cement, glass, and prefab housing factories hit hardest.
In the industrial sector, there were many factories hit, and the only there's absolutely no reason, you see. Many of the places that were hit had nothing to do with any fighting or any arms or whatever, like factories were for dairy products, factories for prefabricated houses, factories for glass bottles and paper mills and timber. Yeah, all the factories, they had nothing to do with the war. The only reason they were hit, they were because they wanted to destroy affect the industry.
Maliban, the second largest glassworks in the Middle East, with production reaching some 200 tons a day, sells not only to Lebanon, but to Egypt, Turkey, Syria, Jordan, Cyprus, Algeria, and even many parts of Europe. The factory was destroyed by Israeli missiles on July 19th, the sixth day of the war. This is Maliban's assistant general manager, Muhideen Nikolaoui.
Israel attacked us suddenly with five missiles, and they destroyed the company. The factory completely, and all the machinery and furnaces, everything collapsed. Machinery becoming pieces, and it will take time, not less than 8 months to 1 year, if we start building now. Nobody knows what's in their mind, but I believe they are destroying everything, and we are in very big crisis. We have nearly 500 families earning money from here. Transporters, suppliers, all they are surviving with Maliban.
Maliban has had to suspend over 200 worker contracts. Tufi Al-Hindi is one of the few factory workers lucky enough to still have a job. Tasked now with clearing up rubble, he says it's clear to him why they were attacked.
Competition, this is why. Because I sell to Egypt, Turkey, other countries, so he thinks it's sure competition. You cannot explain it in another way, this is it.
Several managers of the hardest hit factories agree. Dalal is one of the biggest steel and prefab housing manufacturers in all of the Middle East. It even lists the U.S. Army in Iraq as an indirect client. The factory was destroyed on July 23rd in an Israeli airstrike. This is Dalal's general manager, George Hanna.
They had everything. 25,000 square meter coverage area, factories, all of them damaged. And we have 12,000 square meter yard as storage area with prefabricated houses ready to ship to Iraq and some hangars to Afriya, all of them are damaged now. We think it's about they have also some factories who made the same products like us, and they make this attack to eliminate us from the market.
Liban Ley, the country's largest dairy farm, is another widely cited example of a factory bombed by Israel for reasons of economic competition. In 2001, the company won a $15,000 per week contract to supply the United Nations interim force in Lebanon with dairy products. Prior to that, the contract was held by an Israeli firm. This is Michael Wahed, the company's director.
We were, you know, a quite respectable, I think, quite respectable trademark on the market. And we had, I think, you know, one of the best dairies in the area. The Unifil switched from Israel to us. And this is the reason, you know, because they were satisfied with the quality, with the milk, with everything. And we have been supplying them for the past 5 years, milk, until we were bombed.
Israel has said it bombed facilities it suspected of housing munitions for Hezbollah. But Liban Ley's Christian Maronite owner says the claim is ridiculous.
When you have a contact with the United Nations, and the United Nations contract, they say, you know, they can inspect the factory anytime they want. So, second, we have the Konda people. They come here very often, and they live on the site, and they know every corner of the factory. Hezbollah, are they so stupid to come and put their bombs here? Of all, they come and put in a dairy who has a contact with the United Nations and who produces under a license from a French company. And we have engineers, foreign engineers, will they put their bombs here? You know, this is the third time our factory did get destroyed, three times. In 82, the same thing happened in, I was the founder of Coca-Cola before. I used to be the chairman of the Coca-Cola. And when the Israelis entered, the same thing happened. It's not the first time. So how can you consider Israel as a friend or whatever? You always consider Israel as an enemy. And the only dairy who can compete with them is us.
All the factories are asking for funds from the Lebanese government for reconstruction. But with only $1 billion in aid so far, the country's priorities right now rest with rebuilding roads, water treatment plants, and electricity systems. It will be years before Lebanon returns to being the prosperous country it was only a few weeks ago. For Democracy Now!, this is Anna Noguera in Lebanon.
And that does it for today's broadcast, as we broadcast from the PBS station WEDU here in Tampa, Florida. Today on our Breaking the Sound Barrier tour, I'll be speaking at the Sudikoff Center at Sarasota at 1 o'clock, at 7 o'clock at Tampa Theater, and then we fly off to Chicago. On Wednesday night at 5:30, I'll be at Leverone Hall at Northwestern University, Evanston campus at 5:30. On Thursday, Ann Arbor, the Michigan Theater, also at 5:30. And on Friday, we'll be celebrating WDET, Detroit NPR station, at the Hilbury Theater on the campus of Wayne State University at 7 p.m. You can go to our website at democracynow.org for more details on our Breaking the Sound Barrier DN at 10 tour. Special thanks here at WEDU to Karen and Dick Lobo, and also to Pam Webb. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdokadous, John Hamilton, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Frank Lopez, Aaron Mate, Jen Utes. Special thanks to Dennis Moynihan and Chuck Skurich. DemocracyNow.org is our website, where you can also sign up for our daily digest, for our email list, and you can send off the sites of our tour to friends around the country as we continue our 80-city tour. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.